We've got 15 minutes before we need to go to get the train, which means we have to go to Marks and Spencer's to buy some wine so we can have a nice journey back. Something I want to bring up, you're talking about the gap. Do you remember in the sort of seminar at Wimbledon the other week, the girl from Taiwan who started to suddenly, was such an extraordinary moment. We were talking about language and absence, and she was trying to formulate how difficult it was for her to understand what Giorgio had been saying, but what every week is being said. And then she suddenly started to speak her mother tongue. And it was this, it was really quite traumatic. Yeah. She was very upset. And then she did it again. And I don't know if she was consciously repeating what you'd done, the repeat of an absence that drew, or something that didn't work to draw our attention to it. And you looked quite shaken by it. And I felt shaken by it. And it was.
No, it was an amazing moment, yeah. I guess the way I read it was this, I think wasn't she also interested in the, it was a lot to do with when Tomega didn't say a word, where this idea of dumbing down, of closing down one aspect of communication, then kind of highlights other aspects. And I think she was, the way she was talking was, that's how she feels all the time. You know, when she's in a seminar situation and everyone's talking in English, and she can barely understand what everyone's saying. So obviously, you know, she feels like this outsider, whereby she's not quite it up with everybody else, because obviously it's their first language.
Because they say you say you lose IQ points, don't you, if you're speaking in a second language, your IQ actually goes down.
I think English obviously isn't my first language.
But also feeling like a thing, that when you can't speak, you're a thing. And you know, can find I'm speaking French, and I look at the French person, they're going at me, and I'm suddenly not a person anymore.
Right.
Well, I think that also, I think I said at the time that one of the aspects about going to America not speaking English, or at least American English, was this idea that I was treated differently. You know, I definitely felt this kind of shift in the way I was treated in restaurants, in taxis, as soon as I kind of denied communication, because obviously normally I would have just responded and things would have been normal, but because I didn't reply to questions put to me in English, you know, immediately there was I sensed a difference. It was a physical thing as much as anything, that people backed off,
right?
You know, and all of a sudden it was a bit like, oh, this person isn't what they look like. And they can't speak my language, therefore I'm going to treat them differently to how I would if they did understand. So I suppose there must be an aspect of that as well.
Can I ask a question about chance? Because you talked quite a lot about setting up like situations or frameworks for things to happen.
Yeah.
And you know, that's kind of fascinating. There's also, when you mentioned Martin Creed, I was imagining you two talking about how you don't have to make decisions, you know, over breakfast or something.
Yeah.
Like, what are we going to have for the Shreddies or the Weetabix? Or, God. But also...
that's good.
But anyway, the I was thinking about that, but also in relation to the question about the imagery and how it squares up with the issue of responsibility. Because obviously chance is a sort of way of not always taking responsibility, is it? Because as you say, it's not me, I didn't decide that, it just happened.
No, sure.
So what, is that something that you...
Yeah, well, I'm interested in ethics, should we say, which is a kind of nice way of actually almost subverting what you just said in a way, because in a way, how can you be interested in ethics if you believe in chance? Because, as you rightly say, if you're pleading the fifth, then that could be used against you, as it were, by saying, well, that's very unethical, because it's a bit like, well, you know, I don't think, you know, it's it may be porn, but I'm just showing what's available, you know. That argument, if you like. But I think that's part of it, is that within that, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is there's all sorts of chance, you know. And obviously, because I've been doing it for a while, you know, my instincts kind of guide me. So even though there is a large loss of control, you know, within that there are methods of control that, you know, so in other words, it's not totally up for grabs. You know, I mean, it's a little bit like a system that I know quite well, therefore I've got quite a good instinct about an outcome of something, you know. So obviously, yeah, chance interests me a lot, and I love the idea that all I'm doing is showing what already exists. So I suppose that's the chance aspect of it. That if all I have to do is take out two staples to make my art, then it's almost one staple too many. You know, I'm looking for a magazine that has only one staple. You know, but I've always been interested in this idea of easiness rather than something that is like arduous and hard. You know. I mean, for me, the greatest compliment is somebody who once said it to me as an insult, was that what you do is too easy. And, you know, I want people to think that. I want people to think that what I do is too easy, whatever that means. Because I really think that it's actually quite a painstaking, quite difficult path to get to that point of enlightenment, if you like, whereby what you do is easy, you know. So I suppose I'm looking for stuff, or looking for ways to illustrate that idea that it is easy. It's just a sort of mindset, if you like. And I suppose that's what, again, takes me back to not necessarily be a great believer in the visual. Whatever that means, it's a very sweeping statement, but this idea that somehow there's some kind of truth to an image, you know. I think it's and that's probably takes us back again to this notion of ethics in a way. I mean, I'm also aware of the fact that especially in this day and age where images can be so easily manipulated, that
but it seems to connect to a kind of realism as well. You know, showing the idea of showing things as they are.
Yeah, well, again, I think for me, the documentary, that notion of fact is stranger than fiction. You know, I think that there are so many stories already that are already existing out there that you know, I guess I'm of the opinion that you know, what's the term? You couldn't make it up. You couldn't invent it. You know, it's I guess that's how I view life, in a sense that.
Because I was struck by I don't think you used the word. But I kept thinking of ventriloquism, of like this kind of voice, your voice, not your voice, allowing other people to have your voice, or a struck. And then when you were talking about the gap, I was thinking it's the idea of throwing the voice is actually across something, and it just kept. It seemed to be a theme that kept coming up, that there was this.
Right.
You also almost like you were kind of creating a voice box,
right,
for other people to activate somehow.
Yeah.
And it was your voice. In a way, your voice was not, your voice was giving up as well. It was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And this void, this idea of this empty space, and that's how things are activated. It just seemed to keep coming up. Now, whether that's broad, I don't know, but it like the fact that particularly the guy who made the film, the hands going across, you know, you can't, and then that becomes the documentation.
Yeah.
It becomes sort of like, you know, there's an abdication. There's an, it's not me. It's, I've given it away.
Yeah.
And then I kind of have to claim it back, because that's what I use.
Yeah.
It seems an interesting. Kept thinking of Dead of Night, you know. The
okay.
But with the ventriloquist, is always the puppet master.
Yeah.
It is, but in things like Dead of Night, the puppet becomes, it turns round and it becomes this horror, you know, that it's got a life, and
yes,
it seems interesting.
And the children of famous ventriloquists talk about how the dummy was more of a child than they were, was more living than they were. that was part of the family.
To the parent.
Yes, to their father, who is the famous Hollywood ventriloquist. His daughter is a biography, or his daughter, that Charlie was always with them in the back of the car. They couldn't go on a holiday. They couldn't go anywhere without this other child.
And of course, the dummy can voice the transgressive things that they control. I don't know. I just kept thinking, and where the subject is, because it moves between. But they're both actually in the same place.
I'm curious just to know whether there was any decision or any sort of reaction to a particular type of role of the artist as you were making, because the kind of trajectory is from kind of the early 90s onwards, which was very much in the UK a kind of moment for British artists to be almost kind of celebrity driven. Has that become a kind of conscious choice of yours to sort of to remove the kind of the celebrity of your name and your role as an artist?
No.
Okay.
Mainly because you know, I've always been that way. I mean, it's not been a conscious. I mean, I had to fight it, obviously, because you know, I was just mentioned to Sharon earlier that you know, you there are these ego traps, you know, where you know, you get kind of like for a second under the spell, and you know, if you're lucky, you kind of wake up in time and say, no, I don't want to do that. You know, so I've always been kind of, I was going to say malicious, that's not right, but it's quite interesting to say that. I've always been, suspicious, that's better, of my ego, of why people want things from you, why they might want to give you a free lunch, you know, etc. And I suppose it is a fight. A lot of the time, as I say, these traps that you can easily fall into. And again, it goes back to that kind of my interest in ethics to an extent, that I'm kind of like not really wanting to build myself up to be anything that's in any way special. I've sort of lost my train of thought a little bit. But
celebrity, or this uncelebrity.
Yeah, I mean, exactly, thank you. It wasn't a conscious thing. It just so happened that it's just, that's my character. And for better or for worse, I guess I have this idea that maybe to sell your stock in a particular way wasn't probably worth it, you know. You know, I still buy into that, really. You know, that, you know, magazines used to ask me for images. And so I said, yeah, I'll send you an image if you send me some money for the image. And of course, they don't, because they know there's going to be some artist who will give them images for free. And I guess I grow tired of being, what's the term? I've been recently using this term, which is I'm drowning in my own success, which basically translated means that the more shows I have, the more broke I am. And you know, there is an issue there that if you don't buy into this system, you know, it's quite difficult, because you know, if there aren't massive fees involved, or any fees sometimes, everyone just presumes that as an artist you'll be willing to give images because it's publicity, or do things for free, or, you know. And one of the things that I've been realising, because obviously this is an accumulative thing, if you're not making products. I've nothing against selling art, but for some reason I don't seem to be good at it. And I don't want to start making art that is commercially more viable just for the sake of it. I don't think I could anyway. I don't think it's that easy. But I think tied into what you were saying is this idea that if you don't sign up for the Hello Magazine stuff, then sometimes you do end up poor. Because if you don't join in that system, you know. You know, it's a bit like taking my name off the Milton Keynes exhibition. In the catalogue, I'm not mentioned at all.
Yeah.
So anybody could use that catalogue and say it was theirs because it just refers to the artist. You don't know if they're male or female, never mind what name they have. And so it's little things like that that, you know, I also had my, years back, I had my, again, this idea of language, but I had my CV translated into Latin. And when people ask for CVs for things, I used to send them this Latin version. And then I'd wonder why I didn't get the job or whatever. You know, it's that. But obviously that was, again, testing the idea that, you know, why do we have to do things as we're expected and, you know, all that. But it doesn't always enhance your earning capacity.
So is there a sense that your work is tactical then? Towards systems and infrastructures, and
I think it always has been. Again, through no fault of my own, it's not a conscious decision. But I think in '93, when I did what I would call jettison art for this other thing, I think that was it. There's been no looking back, really. And that once I presented this band's equipment in the space, you know, I couldn't then go back to what I was doing previously. And maybe it's just something that I give off that says doesn't want to make art that sells.
It also seems like quite a lot of the works seem to be sort of potentially ongoing, like, you know, collecting photographs from magazines with balls on, and then, you know, at some point you show it, and you could keep doing that and show it again elsewhere, but it'd be completely different.
No, sure.
And so there's kind of, they're always just open ended. There is no object because there might be some stuff.
Yeah.
But there's no kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because it's just a moment.
Yeah. But I think moments are things, you see. So, No, I agree. In fact, I'm showing 1-2, which was the band piece again, this summer. And it'll be 7-8, because every time it gets shown, it goes up. So it's been shown as 1-2-3-4-5-6, and now it'll be 7-8. But no, I agree. And they are compulsions, you know, they are kind of, again, to talk about being out of my control, in a sense that a lot of my systems, a lot of my collecting, you know, there is a kind of compulsive disorder there, you know, and that's where also one of the true artists thinks that 1 is 3 is 5 is 4 is 4, you know, that's me counting the numbers of letters in each of the words, and then that's another one of my little habits that I used to do. So 1 has 3 letters,
yeah.
2 has 3, and So, I mean, I've always had these compulsions, if you like, of collecting and...
So when if you're showing the band piece again, do people, the curators, request that or say, we want you to be, and then you say, well, do that one again, or is it just as, I'm just interested.
Yeah, on this occasion, it's that specific work.
Right.
It's going to be shown in conjunction with this painter who makes, there was a famous Godard film, I can't remember the name of it, where it's the Rolling Stones in the studio, and it's kind of going to be a sort of version of that. But the band's equipment will be in amongst these screens that are actually paintings.
Right.
I'm suddenly conscious of time.
Yes.
So we must stop. But thank you very much, and thank you, Giorgio. And we're hoping Giorgio will be back to give some tutorials quite soon. Have you agreed?
I have agreed, yeah.
Yeah, he has agreed.
So,
because he's not leaving this room until he says yes.
So watch out. I'll be back.
Thank you.